Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Sabbe saṅkhāra anicca, yad aniccaṁ taṁ dukkhaṁ, yad yang dukkhaṁ taṁ anattā te. For those of you who don't know Pali, that gātā, a small little phrase at the end of the introduction to this evening's talk, simply says that all things which come into being, which are conditioned, which are formulated, which are manufactured, all sankharas, they're all impermanent. And that which is impermanent, that is all dukkha. And that which is dukkha, that is non-self. And this evening's talk, I haven't speaking about anatta for a while, and it's such an important subject that I wanted to dwell on anatta during this evening's talk. It's also a good time to start pointing our minds towards the investigation and realization of the Dhamma, the truth of anatta, in order that we can use whatever samadhi we have gained during this rains retreat. We can use whatever we've developed in order to put it to its use. Now, I've mentioned before that when one is meditating, one should set a goal. Even when one is sweeping, one should set a goal. One should have a purpose for whatever one is undertaking. It is the purpose, the goal, what one is aiming for, which will define one's actions, which will invest it with energy and give it direction. And if one is sweeping, it's to make the paths clean. If it's meditating, you can have these minor goals of being able to watch each and every in and out breath perfectly. It can be a higher goal of being able to enter a jhana. Those goals will mean that we meditate in a certain way, will give energy towards that goal. And of course, the major goal of our monastic life is to become enlightened, to become arahat. That is the one and only purpose for living the monastic life. And that great goal has these sub-goals, these stages on the way. And the first stage on the way, that of sotapanna, the stream enterer, should really be the goal which we put first and foremost in front of our minds when we undertake something like a rains retreat, like a wasa, the rainy season residence. And if we put that goal in front of our minds, it will again give us energy. And it will direct our practice to this one purpose. And this attainment of sotapanna, of stream enterer, is vital and so important. It is the only time, the only attainment after which one can be sure that one is safe, one is secure. In the sense that whatever unwholesome karma which you've performed either early on in this life or in previous lives, it lies stretching back to that which is time immemorial for you. That will not have an opportunity to give fruit in unfortunate existences in the future. It's only when one has attained the state of stream enterer that those, as they say, lower rebirths are forever cut off for you. Just that much will give you amazing amounts of joy and happiness. Just the thought, as the Buddha said, that when he used a simile of just a speck of dust on the tip of his finger, asking the monks, "Monks, what is more, the amount of earth on the tip of my finger, or the amount of earth in this whole planet which we call the earth?" So the monks obviously said, "The amount of earth on the tip of your finger is so small, so tiny, insignificant compared to this great and massive earth." And the Buddha replied, "Just so, monks. The amount of suffering in samsara left for the person who has attained the stage of sotapanna, stream enterer. The amount of suffering, the amount of samsara left compared to what they've been through. It's just like the amount of earth on the tip of a finger compared to the rest of the whole planet." Only at this stage can one feel that one can, with a maybe not an accurate thing to say, but you can say one can rest. Certainly before that one cannot rest at all. And so the goal of sotapanna, a stream enterer, where one is sure and destined for full enlightenment and an ending of this suffering, should be first and foremost in one's mind. And that attainment of stream entry is based on the understanding of this truth of anatta. Sometimes that one enters this attainment through the understanding of anicca or through the penetration of dukkha. But as I said at the beginning of this talk, adapting from the suttas, that if one does see that all sankharas, all conditioned things, everything which is formed, which comes into being, if one sees that all this is impermanent, if one truly sees this, sees it to its depth, then one will also see at that very same moment in time that all of these things are at the same moment dukkha, suffering. Even the pleasant experiences which arise from time to time in our lives, because they arise, because they are conditioned, they are essentially dukkha. All that we see, all that we hear, all that we smell, taste, touch and think, the whole of conscious experience becomes dukkha. It becomes dukkha because it is a sankhara. It is formed, it comes into being and disappears again. Conscious experience is seen as suffering. Sabbe sankhara dukkha. All conditioned things, all sabbe, without exception, is dukkha, suffering. Once that is seen, the result of that, the automatic, whether one likes it or not, without intending, without deciding, the automatic result of seeing the extent of that dukkha is to get this repulsion, nibbida, disgust. Not just, well, to the world, they say. But in the teaching of the Buddha, the world is a world of the six senses. A repulsion from conscious experience as we know it. A repulsion from seeing, from hearing, a repulsion from smelling and tasting, from touching, a repulsion from thinking. Where there is a repulsion, there is a ceasing of those activities. Being repulsed by these activities, one turns away from them. One does not invest them with the delight born of craving, which keeps these things going anyway. Why is it that we look around? Why is it that we listen? Why is it that we spend, especially in the lay world, we spend so much time investing in the search for pleasant tastes, smells and delightful touches, when even the delightful things are dukkha, if one could see that the delightful experiences are dukkha, let alone those which are painful, then we'd have the incentive to shut down all of sensory experience. And the shutting down of sensory experience can be experienced for yourself in the process which we call jhana, where one is shutting down the senses. One is shutting down the sankharas. The Buddha said that samatha, the quelling, the tranquilizing of all sankharas, sabbe sankhara samatha. He said that those who delight in the world just cannot even understand the meaning of sabbe sankhara samatha, of quelling all activities, all sensory activities, all activities of body and mind. They can't even understand why you would want to do that in the first place. But the Buddha made it quite clear that in this sense, these activities, these sankharas, are body sankhara, speech sankhara, and mind sankhara. And the speech sankhara, the vachi sankhara, he called in this way of looking at it, just vitaka vichara, the thought, the consideration. Even to the refined aspect of vitaka vichara, which is just that movement of the mind to its object in first jhana. All of these things are quelled. This is the vachi sankhara, that which we know as outer speech, inner speech, even this movement to speech before the mind breaks into verbalization. All of this is quelled in jhana meditation. One is stopping the sankharas. And why is one stopping these sankharas? Because one realizes that these sankharas are dukkha. And as I've mentioned here before, that the entry into jhana is one of their features is the settling down and vanishing of the first of all the five external senses. The five external senses are especially caught up with the seeking for pleasure in this external world. They're caught up with seeking for that which we call the pleasure born of the five senses. This is kama, kalong ama. And the kama sukha, the world of satisfying the five external senses. If one could understand that the world of the five external senses, even when it's delightful and pleasurable, whether it's sexual intercourse, whether it's enjoying beautiful food, marvelous music, such inspiring sights, sunsets, if one could only understand this is dukkha. Suffering, even when you experience its very heights, it's dukkha. Reason, because what arises passes away. Because the peace is far more refined. That the bliss of Nirodha, when these sensory experiences cease, is so much more delightful. One experiences that for oneself. If one cannot get a hold of this theoretically, intellectually, one gets an understanding of this experientially the first time you enter into any jhana. Why is jhana blissful? Why do people say so much about it? It is because the world of the five senses shuts down. And the world of the five senses, the kama sukha, the happiness born of that world, ceases. And another happiness arises in its place. It's as if you've gone out of something which you will have lived in for so long, you didn't realize it was dukkha. It's like the fish who leaves the water for the first time. Only then does it realize that water was wet. Only when one first leaves the world of the five senses and enters into a jhana does one realize just how painful and how essentially dukkha is that world. So the first thing which one does in this calming of the sankharas is calming the world of the five senses and then calming the vachisankhara, the inner speech, the movement of the mind. And then in the practice of jhana meditation is still to other sankharas which is still operating. First is the kaya sankhara, still a refined bodily sankhara which ends in the fourth jhana. And the last of the sankharas which ends is the mind sankhara, the mind of perception and feeling, just concerned with the mind sense alone. Even that the wise disciple understands is dukkha. Even the worlds of jhanas are dukkha. And so if one lets those go, one doesn't return to the world of the five senses. Understanding that jhana is not sufficient yet, the understanding that jhana is dukkha, does not mean one lets go of jhana and goes into the ordinary consciousness. It means one lets go of the jhana and the ordinary consciousness and goes into nirodha, cessation. Why does one want to cease everything? Where does that incentive come from? Is it a sense of annihilation coming from a sense of self? No. It is coming directly from seeing the extent and breadth of dukkha, seeing that it infects so much that everything gets cut off, just as if a person had a limb which was infected with a disease such as gangrene, it would be taken off and thrown away. But in that simile, just the whole body is infected. The whole of the six senses is infected with dukkha. So the wise person develops, as a result of pure seeing, the disgust, the repulsion to the whole six senses, and thereby lets go. One lets go only when one sees dukkha. And the result of letting go is samatha, is the settling down, the tranquilization. The result of cessation is samatha. And that gives rise to the exiting from the sensory world, the exiting from samsara, the experience of cessation. However, that's one way of understanding the extent of dukkha in this world. That's understanding the extent of dukkha through experiencing the meditation to its limit. But also the Buddha was saying that whatever is dukkha, that is not self. That's anatta, not self. And the first experience of non-self, again the depth and the breadth of it, forms a heart of that which we call the experience of the path, or sorry, experience of the fruit of stream entry. A person who's experienced the fruit of stream entry is someone who has seen anatta, seen non-self. In particular, you will know that this experience is described by the Buddha as the abandoning of what he called Sakaya Ditti. And Sakaya Ditti, if you read throughout the suttas, you find is consistently explained by the Buddha and by the Arahats as the misconception, the wrong view. This is ditti view, the wrong view that one of the five khandhas, that's the body, your body, the feeling, the vedana, the perception, any of the sankharas inside of the mind, the thinking, volition, or consciousness itself, that any of these, or part of these, or something containing these, forms a self, forms atta, forms the heart of you. That is called Sakaya Ditti. When Sakaya Ditti, the view of a personality lurking amongst these five khandhas, is seen completely, at the same time dukkha is seen, at the same time anicca is seen, at the same time dependent origination is seen, at the same time wisdom arises in you, that you know that you have achieved that which we call sotapanna, stream entry. The experience will come with knowledge of the attainment. As such, one can ask, well, why is this so difficult to attain this, what I call like the pivotal point of the practice towards enlightenment? Because once one gains this, all else follows. Why is it so hard to gain this? It must be because somewhere in this world of the five khandhas that there is still a lingering area where we view a self, where we think we exist, we live, we reside. I'll mention here, as I've mentioned many times, that delusion can never be seen when it exists. Delusion, by its nature, is invisible to wisdom. You only know delusion after it's been abandoned. Only afterwards do you look back and wonder, how could you have missed that? How could you have been so stupid? How could you have been so blind? A blind person doesn't know they're blind because they don't know what seeing is. And so, the delusion which is obstructing one, which is the barrier to attaining this first achievement of stream enterer, will be invisible. And so it is one of the jobs of this talk, is to try and uncover that barrier, uncover that invisible block which stops one from attaining this first goal with sotapanna. I was reflecting earlier on, very often, last week when I was reading the suttas, so often the Buddha was talking about monks being liberated through non-attachment, through the relinquishing of all attachments. And very often that we practice, or we think we practice, ways of non-attachment. And if we really could practice non-attachment, not only would we pass through the attainment of sotapanna, we'd go all the way to arahat, through fully enlightened. And it seems at first to the unenlightened ordinary person that non-attachment is easy to do. It is to let go. However, the problem is that the attachment, if you look upon it this way, is a link between that which we call the subject and the object. The link between the subject and the object. To attach, there has to be something in here attaching to something out there. Out there, not necessarily being outside of the body, but it's the object of the senses, object of sensory consciousness. And one of the problems with a person who is trying to overcome attachment is that all we look at is the object of our consciousness, if you like, in this metaphor, in this simile. That which we find delightful or we find unpleasant, that's what we try and let go of. It's the far end of the link rather than the near end of the link. And you find that no matter how many times that you let go of the object of your consciousness, there is that subject of the consciousness still there, untouched and unseen. And that will just go and attach to something else. It's like this hidden hand deep within you, which goes out reaching for objects, reaching for that which is delightful, pushing away that which is painful, through all of the six senses. And all you do with this part of non-attachment is just let go of this object, let go of that object. You haven't followed the hand to its source, where it's coming from. Instead of dropping the objects of attachment, one should look in the opposite direction, where attachment is coming from, who is attaching, what is attaching. And what is attaching, the source of attachment, the, if you like, the place where this hand comes from, is this sense of self, I, me, mine. You first start to get close to this source, this delusion of self, by such contemplations as, who do I take myself to be? Or rather, what do I take myself to be? Instead of saying, who am I? Which is a philosophical inquiry, and which assumes that there's something who you are. That assumption will mean that you will just go wandering around forever, even though you haven't found you yet. It doesn't mean you don't exist. The metaphor I use is something as mundane as, say, the Loch Ness Monster. Even though that people have been searching for this Loch Ness Monster for so many centuries, even though that very expensive investigations with amazingly technologically developed equipment has gone into that body of water seeking out the Loch Ness Monster, they never found it yet, but just because you haven't found it does not mean it doesn't exist. But no matter how many times, no matter how many places you look, you cannot prove that something does not exist through that type of investigation. No more than you can prove to yourself there's not an atta, a self in here, through the investigation, who am I? It's more likely that you'll take something which is another refined illusion to be a self, a me, a mine. At last I found it, this is it, this is who I am after all this time. And you get lost, falling short of the Dhamma. So instead one uses this investigation, what do I take myself to be now? And you find with this sort of investigation, if the mind is powerful and clear, you can see yourself assuming a self time and time and time again. As it says in the texts, this you can call a patilabha atta. We were talking about this just the last sutta reading. The acquired or assumed self, which the Buddha said, you can say, exists. There is an assumed self. It's that assumed self we should investigate and uncover, and to find out that assumed self has no true reality. But that assumed self, the assumption we make, can very easily build up this delusion of me, mine. Where does that assumed self lie? Again, it lies somewhere with the five khandhas. For example, every time you have a pain, an ache, a bruise on your body, ask yourself or be mindful enough to say, am I worried and concerned about this? And if you are very worried and very concerned, you can say, why? Is this my assumed self at this moment, the body? And it will surprise you that even though very often you can intellectualize to yourself that this body has been born of your parents and will lie in a coffin and be burnt, that this body is subject to death, even so you may know that, but if the insight hasn't got deep enough, you find that you actually look upon this body or parts of it as yours. So much so that fear comes up when it gets injured, when it gets threatened with death. You have to uncover this and face this and be serious about this. If you cannot, at least get the insight and the wisdom to understand this body certainly cannot be that which we call self, then there's very little hope you can get to the refined delusions of self which lurk in the mind. Very often we actually take the body or parts of it to be me, to be mine. And fear is a good indication that such a wrong view is still there. One then looks at mind, the four khandhas inside, Vedana, feeling, perception, the sankharas and consciousness, feeling, the pleasant and unpleasant feeling. Why do we get so concerned about aches and pains, disappointment, hearing things we don't like to hear, seeing things we think is wrong and shouldn't be there, itches and aches, headaches, stomach aches? Do we really look upon these things as just something which arises and passes away, just like the grass in the forest, not ours? Do we really look upon it from a viewpoint of non-self? Or are we concerned? Are we very concerned? Are we so concerned that we get angry, we think for days because somebody said something which was dukkha? Because we feel a pain, an ache, because we see something which offended us? Why is it that these unpleasant attributes to sensory experience, or the pleasant attributes, this is what we call Vedana. A conscious experience is pleasant or a conscious experience is unpleasant, no matter what sense of the six senses it occurs. And we should know by now, we should have enough understanding that the pleasantness or unpleasantness of sensory experience is beyond our control. It happens despite us. We try and live with people who say the right things, who do the right things, who are the same as us, who understand what we understand, who have got metta and understanding and wisdom, so they never say stupid and idiotic things. But you cannot do that. Even when I'm by myself, I still hear people saying idiotic things, and it comes from inside my own mind. Let alone when I'm with others. You cannot get away from idiotic sayings. And all of these sensory experience, whether it's delightful or unpleasant, one should know, this is not me. This is not mine. This is not a self. If you can understand that, the result is letting go. It's not something which we'll try and control. Coming on to what we'll call the function of a self, what a self does, it wants to control everything. Or at least it wants to control something. When we come to Vedana feeling, very often you do not take that to be a self, to be a part of your soul, but you take that as being part of your territory, where you wish to exert control, where you wish to try and amass only pleasant sensory experience and abolish unpleasant sensory experience. You should know that is impossible. It cannot be done. Not even the Buddha could avoid unpleasant sensation. Even the Buddha experienced dukkha vedana and sukha vedana and that which was in between. But he could not abolish dukkha vedana and still have conscious experience. When we understand this is not ours, this is not mine, it's beyond your control, just like the leaves in the forest, just like the weather in the sky, then you stop complaining. Every time you hear a complaint in the mind, it's like hearing people complaining about the government and complaining about the weather. At least as a monk, we don't complain about the government or complain about the weather or complain about the football. But we still complain about other people's speech, we complain about our physical pain and happiness. We complain about the state of our mind. We're complaining about Vedana. It comes from the illusion of self. Again, you will not be able to let go of Vedana unless one has abolished the source of this attachment. When it is seen clearly that Vedana is not yours, then letting go happens. Then there is dispassion towards happiness or unhappiness, not before. And the perception which arises in the mind, again one sees perception arising and passing away so quickly. It's like a drop of water, or rather like a rain, a drop of rain hitting a puddle. A little bubble coming up and then disappearing again. Is that right or is it? Is that Sankara? I'll find out in a minute because I'll let my mind alone. All of these perceptions which arise, one should not take those to be a self, to be mine. But the biggest area, the most hardest area to really penetrate is the world of the sankharas, the thoughts, ideas, and in particular the Buddha was saying the most important of sankharas is the chedana, the will, that which chooses, that which decides, that which wills, that which activates this body and mind, that which sankharas it, if you like. That this, and I mentioned this many times before, this is one of the two citadels of the self, or the delusion of the self. And if you have had a very powerful meditation, and if you wish to develop the insight into non-self, then I advise and encourage to put attention on chedana, why the mind moves, why it breaks out into speech and action, why it wills, what will is and where it comes from. Because the chedana very often is manifesting as craving. It's willing to possess, willing to gain pleasure, willing to exist. Why? Where's it coming from? Very often we assume a self in the willing. We assume that it's me, I, who is doing the willing. I am the one who is throwing the switches. I am the one on the control panel. I am the one at the steering wheel, working the pedals. I am in control. And you start to see here why the function of self is to control. And control is called craving. This can be uncovered only if one is brave enough, courageous enough, and sharp enough. Because there is a resistance and inherent resistance to overcoming this delusion of a controller as a maker, a doer, as a house builder, as the Buddha called it. Very often that because of the way we perceive, because of the way we think, thought was so often, we haven't even got the conceptual framework to get close to this thing, the source of will, or the delusion of will rather. And that's why so often it is necessary to gain deep samadhi, where, as it were, one's preconceptions, the conceptual framework which one has learnt, which one is attached to, which one has spent a lot of time reading about, discussing about, tends to fall by the wayside after a decent jhana. After a decent jhana, the mind seems empty, wide of the frameworks of perception and thought and view which delusion has built up over the years. And one has got a chance of, as it were, peering behind the curtain and seeing the truth of non-self. If one can understand and see quite clearly that the Chaitanya, like anything else, arises and passes away according to conditions. When this arises, the Chaitanya arises. When this particular thing arises, a particular type of Chaitanya arises, a particular type of will arises, then it disappears again. It's not coming from you. It's not coming from the self. It certainly is not coming from a God. So often that Christians say they do God's will, but they're just an instrument of God's will. When the self gets out of the way, they just let God do it. You can see that just this, whether it comes from the self or comes from a God or an over-self, an inner self, an underneath self, whatever type of self, it's all delusion. You will know that you've overcome that delusion if you understand Chaitanya, will, is just something which arises and passes away according to the conditions, and you do not ever take this will seriously and personally. One starts to see how it is conditioned, and you start to value the influence of what we call the Kuba Ajahn, because they provide the wise, the kusala conditioning of will. It's only because of the Buddha or the Arahats that it's possible that the ingredients can come up, that Chaitanya can will to destroy craving. Without those, it cannot come from within you. It has to come from outside. That's why a Buddha is necessary in this world for people to become enlightened. when you start to see the conditionality of will rather than taking will to be a self, you're halfway home. Because that's one of the functions of self, is to control the person, the assumed person who's at the control panel. The second delusion is the receiver of information. The, as they say in Thai, puru, the one who knows. It's not one who knows, it's just a knowing. Conscious experience is just that, just conscious experience without anyone being conscious. But so often that we assume that it is a person who is receiving this information. It's a person who is experiencing happiness or suffering. And the result of that will be craving. Whenever there is the assumption that there's someone experiencing happiness or pain, there has to be the attachment to the pleasure, the aversion to the pain. But no matter how much you try and intellectually convince yourself otherwise, if one still has a delusion of a self, it will be the self's prerogative to try and amass as much pleasure and avoid as much pain. The only way we can get rid of this craving, this running after pleasure, this crying and beating our breasts over disappointments and pains and things we don't like, is to see that the experiencer does not exist. It's just experience. There's no one in here. It's just things arising and things passing away, as the Buddha said. Things arising and things passing away are called sankhara. That's all there is in this experiential world. There has to be something, and this is another aspect of anatta which is worthwhile paying attention to. Very often that people look in their mind and contemplate existence, and if they hear such teachings as it's all emptiness, it's all illusion, that's not good enough. It's not good enough because that every human being knows that there's something here. This something is just their loose way of speaking about experiential existence. We experience, as Descartes said, cogito ergo sum, I think therefore I am. What he was saying, that I think therefore there's something. And he just made a mistake that he called it I. This thing which we call conscious experience, seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling and thinking, or just cogitating, or the mental experience, whatever it is, that this is. Conscious experience is. Five khandhas are. They exist. They're not illusion. What is the illusion is taking these things to be something than other than they are. So the Buddha was extremely wise. Instead of just saying that this is not a self, he said what conscious experience actually is. So we can identify this world, we can identify experience, we can identify the whole lot and know what it is and what it isn't. And what the Buddha said it is just something arising and passing away, according to conditions. No more, no less. The arising and passing away. When it passes away, everything passes away. When it arises, everything arises. The all. I forget who asked that to Buddha. The all. What's the all, Buddha? What's everything? Everything is just conscious experience. When conscious experience fades away, so does everything. When it stops, everything stops. It arises again in the next moment. sometimes we think that conscious experience, as it were, arises on a screen, and that screen is the self, just like the cinema screen. Even when the lights go out, the film is ended, the screen is always there. That metaphor does not apply to that which we call conscious experience, the person. As it were, in the metaphor of a cinema screen, when the lights go out, the screen disappears, literally. There is no screen or base of this thing which we call mind and body. It is just sensory experience arising and then completely passing away according to conditions. You say according to conditions because the according to conditions takes away the delusion of it coming from a self or coming from a God. The question why finds its answer not in a self or a God or some overbeing. The question why finds its answer in conditions which arose before. The law of karma, action at a distance, conscious experience, moments or days or lifetimes before, finding their fruit in the arising of conscious experience sometime later. This is what the Buddha called the stream of consciousness, but consciousness which arises and passes away, as it were, like little particles of conscious experience. When they disappear forever. And they cause an arising later on. If one can see this, then there's no place left for the delusion of a self. The truth and reality of experience is explained, and it can be seen as true, it can be realized for oneself, and there's no place for a delusion of a self. There's no one controlling, there's no one receiving the information, it's just consciousness. It's not some being who is conscious. Conscious experience rising and passing away. Pain arising and passing away. Moment, like little granules of sand on the beach. You stand away from it and you think it's this continuous yellow powder with no breaks in between it. You go closer, you see it's small little particles with gaps of nothingness between it. It's gaps of nothingness between conscious experience, like little grains of sand strung along the beach of experience. When one sees all of this, one can never take there to be a self, an I or a me or a mine in there. When there is not a self, when that's realized, it's Sotapanna, stream enterer. And the result of that is one realizes that all sensory experience is dukkha, then the resistance to this is overcome. Because when there's no one in there, there's nothing to be attached to. One can allow the possibility, when one has seen non-self, that everything can be dukkha. When one is attached to some things, one will always say those things one is attached to is a source of happiness. And there's some place in the world, i.e. that which one is attached to, which is not dukkha. Which is all right, which we can, you know, still cling on to. It's only when there's a non-self there that you can let go of everything. If there's a self there, its very function, it has to attach to something. It has to have some reason for existence. It has to have some body by which it identifies itself with, and the body by which it identifies itself with is the object of attachment. When there is a self, the Buddha said, there will be things belonging to a self. When there's things belonging to a self, there will be a self. If you let go of a self, you've let go of belongings of a self. And you truly are one gone forth from the world. One with no belongings. The body, not mine. Vedana,
pleasant, unpleasant, sounds, sights, smells, tastes, touches, thoughts and mind states, not mine. Perceptions, not mine. Will, not mine. Consciousness itself, just something arising and passing away, not mine. When something is not yours, you do not concern yourself about it. You do not crave for it. The cause of rebirth begins to be cut off. Craving. The function of a self, of regenerating itself, manifesting itself, expressing itself, fulfilling itself, all of these little terms which become very prominent in this Western world of psychotherapy, experiencing, fulfilling, enriching, all of these become just so much nonsense to the person who's seen non-self. The point of life is not to enrich experience, it's not to fulfill experience, it's not to have more experience, it's to stop this blooming experiencing, which is dukkha. To stop this delusion which goes reaching out into this world, thinking it's finding delight here and delight there, craving, clinging, causing new birth, new activity. This is what we have to stop. So when you see non-self, when it's that which we call existence, experience, we see is just the rising and passing away of conscious moments. None of this belongs to a self. None of this is me. One sees this so clearly that which we call craving, attachment, will disappear. The experience of Sotapanna is seeing this. And this is its first result. For 1 day, 2 days, 10 days, a long time afterwards, the craving is just not there. What happens though, the Sotapanna is someone who is seen. One forgets one sees. The mindfulness is not perfect yet. Mindfulness, as I've mentioned here many times, also has a function of remembering. This clear awareness not only of what you're experiencing, this clear memory of the Dhamma. There will still be perceptions and conceptions which are originating from an idea of self. Even though view is purified, perceptions and conceptions are yet to be fully cleared up. Moments of heedlessness occur for the person still in training. And that is why for the Sotapanna, the Sakadagami, Anagami, they are still in training. Sekhas. They have to move their pure view into the realm of perception and conception, thinking, analyzing view. And that has to happen as a natural result. It cannot be avoided. Because view is perfected, it has to eventually percolate into the way we perceive things. And that has to seep into the way we conceive. It is only a matter of time before the Sotapanna or the Sakadagami or the Anagami sees things properly. When the Sotapanna starts to see things properly, time and time and time again, conscious moment after conscious moment, by maintaining that mindfulness of non-self, conscious moment after conscious moment, there's no craving going out to the world of the sensory objects. Rather, there's an understanding of this sensory world. It's not me, it's not mine, it's basically an irritation, something I'd rather, or something the mind would rather do without. There is always going to be that turning away from conscious experience. That is where renunciation finds its root. That is why, like, good monks, good nuns will leave the world and stay in monasteries, would leave the halls and the kitchens and hide in their huts, would leave the sights and the sounds of their huts and close their eyes and sneak off into meditation. They are shutting down the world, silencing that which is seen very clearly as an irritation. This is not mine, this is not me. Why be bothered about it? One lets go of that which is not yours. One is unconcerned about it, unbothered about it. And the result of an attainment like Sotapanna is the letting go of the world. One lets go of the world, lessens lobha and dosa, the craving and the ill will, to such an extent that one becomes a Sakadagami, only a once returner. As one lets go of this craving for the things of the world, that one finds it easier to gain jhanas. The ability to achieve jhanas is a result of insight and wisdom. As it's also a training to test yourself how wise you are, how much attached you are to the world. The lesser your attachments to the world, the easier it is to let go of the world and enter into a jhana. Jhana is a measure of one's lack of attachment. Because of right view, it's easier to gain jhanas. Because one does not look upon the breath, the mind, all that one has experienced as being me and being mine, even in one's meditation, when one's sitting cross-legged on the cushion, you're not concerned about these things. The little aches and pains in the body, you let them go, and what happens? They disappear. You get concerned about them and take them up as an object of your mind, and they carry on and get worse. You take an object of thought which keeps bothering you, you take that up and it just carries on and gets worse. You realize it's not me, it's not mine, you let go of it and it disappears. Letting go of something means it drops from you. That's how we know it is letting go. It drops away. Sometimes we think we're letting go, but not really. That's why it keeps there, it stays there. Why does a thought keep lingering in the mind? Why does a particular state of mind keep bothering us? Because we haven't let go of it, we're attached to it. I mentioned some weeks ago, it's crazy mind. This sense of this delusive self would rather attach to anything than nothing at all, and so it will even attach to that which is dukkha, that which tortures you and gives you a hard time. You can't even let go of the disappointments, the pains, the suffering, depressions inside of our mind. Why? Because the self would rather feel depressed than disappear completely. At least it's manifesting its existence. At least it's saying, here I am. At least I'm something. If you can overcome that delusion of a self, then it's easy to let go of all of the obstacles, all of the hindrances to quiet meditation. One can let go of the sense of self. One is not concerned so much with the things of the world. Praise and blame. Why are people concerned with praise and blame? Because they're still assuming the self. Why are people concerned with gain and loss, with fame and lack of fame, with physical pleasure or pain? Because we think it's me, it's I, who's experiencing all of this. instead of realizing that praise and blame and all of these others arise because of a cause. It's not that you've done something wrong or done something right. It's not concerned with you at all. It's just a working out of karmic phenomena. These things arise and pass away, whether you like it or not. You can't do anything about it. Let go, beyond your control. When you're beyond your control, the praise and blame just do not reach you. Just words arising, passing away. Just sounds. Sounds reaching the ear door. The combination of the external sound and the ear consciousness creates contact, which creates the feeling. Unpleasant sounds. They pass away again. It's just conscious experiencing. Conscious experience is manifesting itself as its nature. Many years ago, I went to stay with Ajahn Ben in Wat Doi in Sakonikon. He's one of the Aryas, marvelous monk. I only remember the beginning of the talk, because this was 16 years ago, I think. The beginning of the talk he gave, he was about to start his Dhamma Desana, his talk, and just a bird called in the distance. He said, listen to that bird, that's just the nature of birds to call like that. Nothing wrong with it, nothing right with it. It's Dhammata, he said. It's like the nature. It's the nature of the mind just to be this way. Not good, not bad, it's not you, not someone else, it's not mine. And just the way that we can let that bird call in the distance, we can just let these things arise and pass away in the mind. And when the bird stops calling, the mind is silent. The forest is still. Then we know that letting go, non-self, no craving, is apparent. And when through the training, the mind remembers continually that perception and conception is purified, that all experience, all the six senses, the five khandhas, are regarded as non-self, not mine, not me. Then whatever experience comes up in the mind is just an experience. Just seeing is just seeing, hearing is just hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, cognizing is just that, just experience. Not only is there nothing to shake the mind in the world, also there is nothing to keep it going. The conscious experience was just that at the beginning. And when the delusion stops, conscious experience loses that which generates it from life to life. There is cessation, ending. And that ending is called parinibbana, nirodha, cessation. And that is our goal. And the pivotal point is this full understanding of anatta, especially as you're experiencing the ground of experience, the experiencer, the willer, the chooser. That's where one should put the attention. Instead of the screen, just the projector. Instead of looking at the objects of experience, the subject, and to see this as illusion. Do that, and the mind will be free. And you'll know the Buddha's teachings. You'll understand why the Buddha said things the way he did. And then you'll have unshakable faith in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. You'll never have any doubts about what is the right path and what is the path of delusion. And you'll understand the meaning of sabbe sankhara anicca. And yad anicca, tang dukkhang, yang dukkhang, tad anatta. Any questions about this evening's talk? Yes. You're asking if the insight into anatta happens with one khanda at a time, or does it all the khandas together? You'll find that the insight into anatta will happen first of all stage by stage. There'll be certain things which you've taken to be a self, which you realize have no right to be taken as a self. But there will come a time when you're, as it were, the army will be like attacking the city, and they will go through the outer suburbs and the inner suburbs, and eventually they'll come to the citadel where the, as it were, like the leader, the person in control hides out, and they'll attack that citadel, and they'll break into that citadel, and they'll find that the controller, they find it's empty, there's no controller there anyway. But they've got to break into that citadel first of all, because behind those walls there's this delusion of the self. And saying that the citadel, as I understand and experience these things, the citadel for most people is either the will or the consciousness, taking one of those two things to be the very source and essence of self. Then once one climbs the walls into that citadel, then the whole delusion, like the pack of cards, you've gone to the root of it, and then the whole tree falls down. The whole pack of cards tumbles, and the citadel crumbles. So in one way, it's true to say there are the, if you like, the external defences of the ego. You know, the external things you think are in your control are let go of. Then there's a samana, there's a person who's living a monastic life. You find that much of monastic life is letting go of control of many areas of your life, which as a lay person you thought you had a right to control. The whole movement towards human rights in this world is coming and based on the delusion of self, thinking that we have an area which we have a inherent right to control. I'll be very careful that this never gets played in Nolamara, because even like women's rights want to have the right over their body, which is like control over their body, and control over maybe the child in their womb. Then there are areas which we think we have a right to control. When you come into a monastery, much of that area where you think you have a right to control is taken away from you. You can't control the way you sit, the way you walk, the way you put on your clothes, what time you get up in the morning, what chants you do, what food you eat. And for somebody coming into a monastery, leaving the world, you find how much of what you think, you know, is your freedoms are actually taken away. Much of the training in what we call core what, you know, the monastic routines and the rules of discipline, is taken away many of your freedoms to choose how you do something, how you go to the toilet, how you carry your bowl. It's taken away freedoms. Your freedom to enjoy yourself. Even your freedom to go to the doctor or dentist to have the toothpaste you wish. Just have to put down on the book, toothpaste, and you're given whatever toothpaste the Stallman wishes to give you. And this would be just outrageous for a layperson. Can't even choose their own toothpaste. Not even in a prison or a concentration camp, probably. You're taking away those freedoms. And here you're not even allowed to think what you like to think. No sensual thoughts are allowed. No thoughts of sex. So you can see just how monastic life is taking away your freedoms. After a while of taking away these freedoms, actually you feel more free. It's one of those contradictions of monastic life, that once you become at ease with the rules of discipline, with the core what, the monastic regulations, with getting up in the morning, with meditating, you actually feel much more free than you did as a layperson. You find that these aren't human rights at all, these aren't freedoms, these are burdens, these are afflictions, these are weights on the mind. These are just burdens which the ego creates. And you do let go of these things bit by bit at first. You let go of the concerns of the world. You let go of the concerns of the monastery. You let go of the concerns of your body. And you let go of the concerns of your mind. And then you enter into things called jhanas. And that's freedom. And the more one lets go, the closer one is to unravelling and exposing oneself. And eventually, as I say, you have to come to those citadels. They're hard to scale. They're hard to get close to. But there will come a time when you uncover the delusion of self, and it will be accompanied by great piti-sukha, great bliss. It will be accompanied by enormous understanding of the Dhamma, very much as if, because you understand the heart of the Dhamma, you understand the whole of the Dhamma, the source from where all these teachings arise. And you will know that that experience has happened. And you will know that you are destined for enlightenment, and nothing will stop you. That you will understand that the five khandhas are mortally wounded. They're terminally ill. And the process can only last at most 7 lifetimes. More probably less. Sorry, does that answer your question? Is there another question about this evening's talk? If you haven't achieved the sotapanna, the experience of non-self yet, you're still in great danger. So do not be heedless.